If you remember last class, I showed you all this amazing picture, which was taken by someone who is listening to us now. Here it is enlarged. I'll enlarge it for you. A very nice picture. This never appeared public until last Monday night, as well as the other one I showed you with Lieberman and his Talis, and there's another one I'm going to show you. The picture was taken by the person who's on with us now, who sent it to me. Okay, very nice. I showed you the picture. To show you how things work in the internet, this is what we have. One of our listeners, but he's not with us every week, wasn't with us last week, Heshi from Brooklyn. He emailed me today as follows. Just about hold on a second, let me get out of this.
Was I 71? Said 70.
Hold on a second.
73 years old. One other point I just want to make you about pictures is I showed you this picture last class.
Hold on, I just have to get rid of that image there. For some reason, it was all okay. I want to show now. Now I can get you again. He sent me this. Look at this. And here's his email. Mark, a Bub of Chassid sent this to me. I'm sure you've seen it, but you never know. Now, this is modern technology. This Bub of Chassid pulled it off the YouTube video. And those are the people identified. I'm the one I put it on. It's on the picture on the YouTube where it says JTS Hoshana Rabbah 71. And now this is going around to all the different Hasidic WhatsApp groups, because I can tell you from the wedding I was at 2 weeks ago that I showed you the picture of, lots of people in the Hasidic world are interested in Lieberman. Now, presumably, someone's going to put it on one of their websites, and then it'll be out there. If they don't, it's okay, because I'm going to put it on my next blog post. But look, this is so it's just funny, Heshi, that we only made this public last week. No one in the world saw this. But this Bubba Bar Chassid has good technical skills, so he was able to take it off the YouTube and just make a copy of it. Now,
if I could just mention that this is exactly how they sat on Shabbat when I would see them on Shabbat and services with my teacher, Dr. Finkelstein, Alev HaShalom, sitting in the front row on that seat. And right next to him was Professor Lieberman. And then others of my teachers started moving closer to where they were, including Max Kedushin, Alev HaShalom, who was my teacher. He felt he should sit in the second row.
Okay,
and
well,
so that's where I would see him.
You'll see, you'll help us identify people in the other picture I'm going to show you later. Not today. But in terms of pictures, I want to set the record straight. So if you recall, I showed you this picture as well. Now, this is the picture of Lieberman right after I got married. Now, this picture now is on the internet because I put it on the internet in one of my posts. But I wrote when I put it on that I found it on my computer and I don't remember who gave it to me. I have no idea where it came from. And it's been bothering me for at least a year and a half. And I asked in the blog post, does anyone know who gave this to me? If you're reading it, tell me and I'll attribute it to you. And lo and behold, just today, as I'm going through all my Lieberman stuff, I found the answer. It's Mayor Bar-Ilan. From Bar-Ilan University, who is Mishpacha. So I'm going to correct this on the blog that I did this. And so just to set the record straight, it's Mayor Bar-Ilan. Okay, some questions. The problem is that... There are many people who are listening who know a lot about Lieberman, and that's always dangerous. It's like dangerous if you have a rabbi in your shul. If a rabbi has congregants and they know a lot, you don't want them to know nothing because then they're not paying attention. But if they know too much, then it's a problem. So there's a lot of you who not only know listening both live and even not live, probably more not live, who know an enormous amount about Lieberman. So I just got to raise my game a little bit. So or to answer the questions that you said I should have. A couple of things I want to get to. I listened to last class. First of all, Confessions of Sins, like they did in Novartis. Some of you asked questions on it. Others you pointed out that it's not just Novartic. I will deal with this, if not next week, the week after. I have a number of books in Scranton, and I want to have everything together to talk about before I speak about this idea of confessing your sins to other people or even publicly. I'll talk about Hasidi Ashkenaz, the tshuva of Rav Meir of Eisenstadt. I'll deal with all of that in 2 weeks. I mentioned, I just want to show you, we spoke about Rav Shimon Shkup. We'll speak about Rav Shimon. This is what I meant. Someone wasn't clear what I said. So on his chidushin, it's, you see, Shimon Yehuda. They don't put a hey at the end of the, after the Dalit, because it looks a little like the Tetragrammaton. In the Sephardic world, actually, this is how they often do it. They do a double thing. It's not, it's, they put the, instead of the, they put the Aleph instead of the hey at the beginning. So it's Yehuda. Now, as for Rav Shimon, the problem was, it's not like I prepared this. It just, it was off the cuff. So I couldn't remember all the details. And a number of you helpfully sent me in all the details, which I thank you all for that. Like I said, it's if you're doing it off the cuff, you, I can't remember all these things. But this is what I was referring to. The grandson of, well, first of all, the daughter, granddaughter of Rav Shimon Shkup, Fega Ilanit, who was a Mapam, so you see she's not exactly in line with religion. In fact, she was a, she rejected the whole notion that children brought to Israel were placed with irreligious families, things like that. But her son, who was killed, I thought it was 48, you know, I couldn't remember. It was actually in 55, he was captured in an operation. He was committed suicide, and as it says here, in a Syrian prison, he became a symbol of courage and patriotism in Israel. He was, you know, he became an important symbol in Israel. And this is Rav Shimon Shkup's great grandson. They've published some of the letters of Rav Shimon to his granddaughter, who he obviously loved his granddaughter, and they were quite close, but in completely different worlds. I feel like I shortchanged Ibn Ezra, because I listened, well, again, what I said about Ibn Ezra was that he was an astronomer, astrologer, not really an astronomer. It's incorrect. And I thank Rabbi Weiss again for catching my mistake here. Although astronomy and astrology are very much alike, but Ibn Ezra was an astronomer. He even wrote a treatise on the astrolabe, which is an astronomical instrument. Professor Bernard Goldstein of Pitt, I once had an interview of Pitt at the University of Pittsburgh. He's written an enormous amount on medieval Jewish science, and even has an article on astronomy and astrology in the works of Ibn Ezra. So thank you. Correction for that. Just a couple other comments before we begin. We have a rabbi who was at Ner Yisrael, Rabbi Dov, I'll call him, from 1969 to 1975, received smicha from Rav Werderman, and he testifies that Rav Werderman told him privately that the altar did not want him to room with Lieberman because he didn't want Rav Werderman to be influenced by Lieberman's pursuits of broader interests. In other words, he wanted to keep Rav Werderman focused on traditional Torah study. But the idea, as Ovadia points out correctly, the idea that Lieberman would have been expelled from Sobolka, that's really impossible. Because remember, he got the shidduch he got. He never would have got such a shidduch if people thought there was a problem with him. A couple other things. I after listening to the class, I thought to give you an example for Al HaYerushalmi of what Lieberman's doing with amending texts. But I tried. It's too complicated to explain it, I think, for a broad audience. But those who are interested, I'll just recommend to go to Al HaYerushalmi, page 80, note 118, and you'll see what Lieberman does and how he explains various Talmudic passages in Yerushalmi by amending the text. And so I say that. Let's see. A couple other things. Joseph reminds me of Rabbi Nissen Waxman. Nissen Waxman, the father of Professor Chaim Waxman, the grandfather, there's Ram, I think he's a Shalvim, Rabbi Ira Waxman, has an essay on Talpiot. It's also reprinted in a volume of his Shvilei Nissen. And if you look on page 188, he speaks about the Mechitor and Lieberman and the time Lieberman was there And Lieberman was studying through a correspondence course, medicine. And then on page 191 and 192 about how they all played chess. So thank you all for that. And two more things. I said something which wasn't correct, or at least I didn't say it actually about Yerushalmi. I implied, or I might have even said that Lieberman, when he went to Epstein, he probably had knowledge of Yerushalmi, but he didn't have any method, and he didn't know. So when he got the modern approach, he inserted it into his study. And a lot of people assume that. But Ovadia points out correctly that, I mean, at least Lieberman claimed, there was a special issue of Hadoar, and Tovia Preschel has an article in it, and he claims that when Lieberman was asked to do a translation of the Yerushalmi into Hebrew, he said that he never has studied it. So how could he do this? And then he devoted a year and a half to studying it. So maybe this is Lieberman just being modest. I mean, it's hard to imagine that Lieberman had never actually opened the Yerushalmi. But as well, I have to say that it's not just that. His brother, this is mentioned in the Spiro book, page 284, They translate an article by Dimitrovsky, and he quotes the brother. Shaul Lieberman had a brother named Meir, who I don't know if he was Eda Charedit, but he was very close to the Brisker Rav. You know, it was very frum to use that term. And Meir says that he only began learning Yerushalmi when he came to Eretz Yisrael. So if that's the case, again, I find it a little hard to believe, maybe learning it intensively, but to say he never opened it up. But if that's true, that he didn't really start learning, and even if he only learned it on a surface level, what he was able to accomplish within a year or so, a year and a half, to then be able to be an expert in it, to write Ali Yerushalmi is incredible. Later on today, I'll tell you something else about the Yerushalmi. And finally, two more things from Nachum Shamaria tells me. He doesn't know anything about Lieberman and the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I thought maybe there were some short letters. If Nachum Shamaria says he doesn't know anything, then I believe him. But I will show you stuff that show about the Rebbe's relationship. I'm going to show you, not this class, in a future class, video of the Rebbe at Dov Zotnik. And you'll see, you get a sense of how the Rebbe related to people in the conservative world. And then a video of him and Bernard Mandelbaum. And that's even more interesting because the Rebbe says something that is really going to be enlightening and shows us the Rebbe's path versus the so-called orthodox path. And I'll also tell you then about my confrontation at the wedding with Dov Zlotnik. Wait to hear the story. I think you'll all be on my side, but as a Talmud Muvak, as a great student of Lieberman, we'll understand what Zlotnik was also exercised as well. And finally, just to reply to Howard, he says that when I discussed Yerushalmi, but I'm going to discuss more of it now, Yerushalmi Kipshuto, but I need to also stress the necessity for an accurate text as possible through manuscripts. Yes, of course. That's what Lieberman thought was vital. A thorough knowledge of the vocabulary, grammar, and syntax of the language at hand. And he wants to know, where did he get grammar, Greek, and Latin? Well, he learned in the university with Professor Moshe Schwab. He really became an expert in Greek. I spoke to Louis Feldman once, also at a wedding, and he was quite impressed, although Lieberman was not a classicist. Feldman, who was a classicist, was quite impressed with Lieberman's knowledge, although there is an article in one of the Neusner volumes. We'll get to Neusner as well. Lieberman's career, his final article of his career, deals with Neusner, so we'll get to that. But he published something after Lieberman passed away. Neusner took his revenge, published a volume like Saul Lieberman's Error or something like that, and he has an essay in there by someone, you know, did Saul Lieberman know Greek? So hopefully we'll get to that. But believe it or not, in the Spiro book, it mentions that even as a youth in school, I guess the local school, that Lieberman had picked up some Greek. And finally, Howard says that I made a statement that the Babylonian Talmud did not know the Tosefta, and then he points out that it's not true. There's Toseftas that appear in the Gemara. I don't think I said that. What I said, I was giving an example of higher criticism. And higher criticism, an example of it would be, for instance, you would say that the Talmud says this thing here, and yet it only says that and gives that explanation because it doesn't know of certain sources, such as perhaps a Tosefta or you know, another a Bryce or something like that. And if you look at the higher critics, when they try to remake the Talmud, as it were, that's what they will point to. But I wasn't making any blanket statements that the Talmud didn't know Tosefta. Okay, that's enough for now. Let us pick up. A lot to do here today. We ended last class. We spoke about the book Ahli Yerushalmi, Lieberman's first academic work, which he sends to the Chazon Ish. We saw the Chazon Ish's reply that he wasn't enamored by it at all. This letter from Lieberman to the Chazon Ish, I was surprised, is actually included in the collection of the Chazon Ish's writings, which Gnuzim v'Chsheros Shuvas Chazon Ish, and they refer to the Lieberman very respectfully as his relative, Zichron Livracha, Chazon Ish, Zichron Livracha. Let me go on about the Chazon Ish, because we have other evidence of their relationship. So, for instance, I published something in Saul Lieberman the Orthodox, a very short letter from the Chazon Ish to Lieberman at the end. Lo and behold, this letter is picked up and it's included here in the volume. I was told by someone that he actually saw Saul Lieberman the Orthodox in B'nai Brak, which is, that's okay. They could have it in B'nai Brak. So what's this letter? I found it, after I published this, I saw that Aviana Cohen had also found it. And right before my thing came out, he had published it as well, but in a place in some Israeli periodical, which I hadn't seen. And I'm assuming the people in Israel got it from my little book here, but it doesn't matter. It's there for anyone to come look at it. I remember going through Lieberman's stuff and I saw the letter of the Chazon Ish. I mean, I was shocked. First of all, if this would be an auction, it would be a fortune to get it. But I remember holding the letter, and to actually hold the letter of the Chazon Ish, because they have the original letter there. I hope they have good security there. This is the exact sort of thing that people would go and like to stick in their pockets and walk out with. To hold the letter of the Chazon Ish, actually, if you've been reading the news recently, the more thing you have to be worried about is JTS not selling it. If you don't know what I'm referring to, just Google Elie Fisher. I wrote a whole thing about how Bar Ilan, their archive ends up on the auction block. No one pays attention. But of course, Elie Fisher writes, he's dealing with a $100,000 manuscript. The seminary, I don't know their financial state, but they're secretly, and they've done it other times as well, but he uncovered that they sold this. So I hope they don't start selling their manuscripts, because they're letters of Gedolei Yisrael. But I remember it was an amazing thrill to hold the letter of the Chazon Ish. And what this, it doesn't really say so much, but it's the very fact that it's the Chazon Ish writing to him that's significant. What does the Chazon Ish say? It's this is from 1936. And it just says, I got your letter. I'm writing this in the house of my mother, she came to them, Eretz Yisrael with them. She's very interested in how you're doing. And then he says, your questions, you're not asking the right person. Why does he say you're not asking the right person? This is great from the Chazon Ish. Because I don't have Bekiut. I don't have the Bekiut because I don't have the Girsa of the Yankos. I don't have like I had my youthful mind. And he says, but apparently you're right that this doesn't appear in the Gemara. So it's the Chazon Ish's modesty, but also confessing that on this matter, Lieberman, you know better than I do. I guess that's how you read it. We have two other things from the Chazon Ish, from Lieberman to the Chazon Ish. We do not have from the responses to these in Lieberman's correspondence. Maybe there's other places where you have Lieberman archives. Professor Bar Ilan has some of it, so maybe it's there. But actually, no, what we do have, we do have the ones I'm going to show you now are letters of the Chazon Ish. Two amazing letters of the Chazon Ish to Lieberman. We don't have Lieberman's letters to him. I had a feeling about this. I mentioned this in my Lieberman booklet. You have the three volumes of the letter. Actually, it's four volumes, but the first one is volumes one and two, and the second is volume three. In this volume, it's called Kovetz Igros Chazonish. And this is the first ones came out in the 50s. This one came out, I believe, in 1990. It's just letters to Chazonish. The problem with this, they don't tell you who wrote the letters, who the letters are to, and they leave out a lot of personal information, but they have ellipses, two dots. So I'm actually thankful that they, unlike most Haredi publications where they just cut it out without telling you, they actually tell you who they are leaving it out, when they leave something out. But if you look on volume three here, numbers 19 and 20, I had a suspicion that this was to Lieberman because he begins, Habal Shun Nut, the Targum HaMilim, he talks about how he's not a philologist. And if you spend too much time on philology, you miss the whole point of Torah study. Then he starts speaking about the Tosefta. So I said, it has to be to Lieberman. And then the next letter as well. And lo and behold, Professor Shlomo Pick, Rabbi Shlomo Pick. I think they should call him rabbi, not professor, although he is a PhD. He's a YU Musmach. He works at the Bar Ilan Kollel and a big time Chacham. He's written an entire book on Rav Sol in Hebrew on Chidushim of Rav Soloveitchik. He's written stuff in English as well as many other things. I knew that he was close to members of the Chazon Ish's family. So I asked him to investigate. How do I know this? I knew this from years before because in my volume, I published the collective writings of Rabbi Chayak of Weimar, volume one. I have a letter in the back. And in there, I have a note. The letter is from Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski to Moshe Avigdor Amiyah. Moshe Avigdor Amiyah, we'll do classes on him one day. The Rav of Tel Aviv, formerly the Rav of Antwerp. He created a new approach in Lundus, a big Mizrahi person. There were three candidates for the chief rabbinate position in the state of Israel. The chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv in 1935. There was Rabbi Herzog, there was Rabbi Soloveitchik, and there was Rabbi Amiyah. And Rabbi Amiyah won. There is a letter in the letters of the Chazon Ish from Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski to the Chazon Ish, but they remove all the personal names in which he speaks about who should be chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. He writes this to the Chazon Ish, and so Rabbi Soloveitchik told his students that Rav Chaim Ozer was speaking about him. Because in the letter of Chaim Moses says that this person I'm saying, he's not a Mizrahi person, but he's still important for him to be chief rabbi. Because the Mizrahi in those days controlled everything. Well, we know that Rav Herzog was Mizrahi and Rav Amiyah was Mizrahi. So Rav Soloveitchik assumed must be referring to him. Lo and behold, it's not him. I had Rabbi Pick get the answer, and I revealed it for the first time in that volume. It's, believe it or not, Rabbi Yosef Shlomo Kahaneman, who is in the Ponevez Yeshiva. Why Rav Chaim Ozer thought that Rav Kahaneman should leave the Ponevez Yeshiva and go to Eretz Yisrael and become chief rabbi there, I don't know. I guess he thought maybe he'd bring the yeshiva there. So I knew that Shlomo Pick had the relationship to the family. And he confirmed for me that, lo and behold, these letters, 19 and 20, are from the Chazon Ish. Later, I wouldn't have needed that because in volume three of this new volumes is Genozim B'Shelos Tshuvos Chazon Ish, pages 319 and on, they tell it that they say that this is to Professor Reb Shaul Lieberman. So, when I came out with my book, Solomon Orthodox, this had not appeared yet. So what do these letters say? So again, you get a sense of what, we don't have the years to it. That's a problem. And since he mentions Tosefta, I might assume that it's when he was already living in America, when he started with Tosefta Kipshuta, but I don't know because he still dealt with Tosefta. But listen to what the Chazon Ish tells Lieberman. It sort of fits in what we saw already. He says that it's true that philology and proper translation of words do have a share in the Torah. When, you know, there's no question that in studying Talmud, but those who run after it and make it into something too big, that's not what's good. He says, listen to this. Ein ha-Torah mitzuya bein ela she'osim et melachtam kevav et iyun ha-mukari. That is, those who their major focus is on philology, things like that, as opposed to lumdus, as opposed to understanding, it's the old criticism of the Wissenschaft scholars. They're more interested in what Rashi wore than what he said. And by the way, you can publish an article in Academic Jewish Studies in all the journals, let's say about Rashi. It's all everything about Rashi, where he lived, what he dressed, all these sorts of things. But if you submit an article trying to explain what Rashi meant in understanding of sugya, let's say, that's for the rabbis. That's not for us. So Lieberman's approach would be the exact opposite. That's the ultimate. But he's saying this is the criticism of Chazon Ish. He's saying for the people whose focus on philology and grammar and history and all these things, as opposed to talk everything about the rabbis, as opposed to what the rabbis say, that's wrong, that's bad. And then he says, for those who are amazing the Torah, who focus on real Torah study, the work in pre avodatam shachokrei aloshon moil rak itim rochokov. That is, occasionally you can learn something, and if your focus is on the sugya and understanding Talmud the way it should be, occasionally you look in Dikduke Sofrim, you'll see there's a different manuscript. You'll see that maybe you can open up the Sansino, or Salvechik used Sansino when you didn't know what words meant. You could see they'll tell you that this is a this is a Greek word. So now you know what the Greek word means. Okay. Or Rashi will tell you this is what it means in laws. So now you can look in Steinsaltz. Before you'd have to go look it up in one of the Moshe Katan's French dictionary to tell you, or you'd see a picture, from the Talmud. That could help a little bit. But there's Ikar and Tafel, we say. The main thing is to be a traditional Talmud Chacham. And he's telling this to Lieberman. Basically, he's criticizing Lieberman that you're spending your time on these other things, what he calls Dvarim Kalei Erech, insignificant things. And he says the purpose of someone who is mitamel, get into a sugya. I don't know how best to translate it. What's the purpose of it? The tochen. That's the purpose. Not the Targum Milim, not to talk about, how this word, like Lieberman did, is derived from the Greek, and that enlightens us on what it means. That's all nice, but that's after you've mastered it. And then he starts speaking about the Tosefta, that the Tosefta, we can't rely on the text of it because there's all sorts of problems. We don't have a tradition on the text, and therefore you can't start quoting the Tosefta to explain the Mishnah, give a different explanation of it, because we don't have, we have all sorts of different versions of the Tosefta. Ein lanu reshut lishtamesh ba ela l'rosa bovad, he says. He's punning on something else. We can't use the Tosefta just to look at it, but we can't. We have to explain the Mishnah and the Halachos, the Gemara, ki'ilu ein lanu kana tosefta, as if we don't have the Tosefta. He's worried about the higher criticism here. You're going to start giving different explanations of the Mishnah based on Tosefta. But we can't rely on the Tosefta. This is similar to the Chazon Ish. He thought that in the Meiri, that you can't really use the Meiri. You can use it for to look at it, to understand maybe what he's saying, but you can't use it for Halacha. You can look at a Meiri if you want to get an explanation of the text, but you can't bring Meiri to explain halacha practically. You can't cite him and respond to him because he hasn't been part of the tradition. And he would say, El Rosa Bovad, he would say, you look at the Meiri, but he's not part of our tradition. The Tosefta is not part of the tradition either. And then he says, in the end, Ein ani ragil b'chipusim uv'cheker kadmonios. He says, this is not my path, going into historical things. And when I read this, I'm thinking, who did the Chazon Ish correspond with who did this? As far as I know, no one other than Lieberman. And therefore, I had a sense it had to be Lieberman. And lo and behold, it was Lieberman. And then he continues the next letters, similar sorts of things that. So you see Lieberman, he's departing from his cousin's path. There was never a break, as far as I know. The Chazon Ish was giving him Musar. That's okay. The Chazon Ish could give Musar, like Dov Zotnik will give me Musar. But I'm going to be giving, I wrote about Svi Yehuda, that other student of the Chazon Ish. They were, lo and behold, they're doing a whole program in Israel in October about these letters of the Chazon Ish to Svi Yehuda. If you don't know what I'm referring to, just Google it, because this is a student of the Chazon Ish who often went to a different path and even the more academic approach. The Chazon Ish, he had difficulties with some of his students. Of course, we already spoke about Chaim Grada. By the way, Chaim Grada, I forgot to mention this. Lieberman knew nothing about Chaim Grada. Lieberman told the whole story. He became a big fan of his as to how he learned about Chaim Grada. It was his brother, Meir, the from the Orphan Eretz Yisrael, he told Lieberman, you have to read this Chaim Grada. And Lieberman, you know, Lieberman's going to read novels. He's like, well, why should I read? So Meir said to him, read it. And Lieberman read it, and he became so attached. He writes about how, because Chaim Grada, it was serialized in one of the Yiddish papers every month, or I think it was every month, every week, I forget now. And Lieberman writes that he would wait for every week for, you know, the serial, the novel, to the continuation of it. So that's enough for the Chazon Ish for now. We spoke about Al Yerushalmi. Lieberman begins with this. And he remained attached to the Yerushalmi the rest of his life. He loved the Yerushalmi. Although we'll see that he moves to Tosefta, he still remained, had this attachment to the Yerushalmi. It's not because of Rav Kook. There have been people who have said, well, you know, Rav Kook was into the Yerushalmi. It's nothing to do with Rav Kook. Rav Kook was very into the Yerushalmi. Rav Kook has a whole metaphysical approach to the Yerushalmi. That the Yerushalmi, when we return to Eretz Yisrael, we have to now study Yerushalmi. And he thinks that the Yerushalmi has certain characteristics that are, that make it like on a higher level. It's Eretz Yisrael, Torah. That's, you don't have any of that in Lieberman. Why he loved the Yerushalmi, maybe because it wasn't studied so much. I would think just because it's a challenge. We have a whole tradition of how to read the Bavli. We have Rashi and all the commentators, the Yerushalmi. We don't have it. So, it's like a meis mitzvah. It's like, it's a halachic work. It's important work, a Talmudic work that people haven't focused on. So it's almost like, it's not just a challenge, but it's a religious obligation to try to make it understandable. He says as follows. After his wife passed away, this gives you a sense of how attached he was to the Yerushalmi. You can find this in Spiro on page 137. I should say Spiro on Shochet. After his wife died, after Judith Lieberman died, we spoke last class, I told you about what he endowed in Ramot Shapiro. He also endowed, you can see this in Spiro as well, page 13, a Judith Lieberman Prize for Torah studies. And lo and behold, it was given to Nachabon Leibowitz in 1980, 1981. And the correspondence between Leibowitz and Lieberman was published because Lieberman said this about Nachama. There is not in our generation even a single individual, whether male or female, whose contribution to Jewish education equals yours. So Lieberman was very happy that in memory of his wife, it was given to Nachama Leibowitz. But on page 137, he says as follows, speaking about the death of his wife. The Palestinian Talmud owes me nothing, but I owe all my life to it. Even when my most precious companion was taken from me, the Palestinian Talmud did not forsake me. It comforted and sustained me, and it will not, I hope, abandon me in my old age. This comes from, he wrote an essay, a text where he said, Talmud written by the people in their own land. They used to call the Talmud Yerushalmi, not only Jerusalem Talmud, they would call it the Palestinian Talmud. For example, if you look also in Ginsberg, Ginsberg wrote, four volumes on the Yerushalmi Brachos? If you look on the English title page, it's the Palestinian Talmud. Now they call it often the Talmud of Eretz Yisrael. So we see this connection to the Yerushalmi, and Lieberman published throughout the 30s, he published in Tarbitz. In those days, he had two important periodicals of Jewish studies, Sion, which is historical, and Tarbitz, which is for rabbinic studies, philosophy, also history. He published a series of articles called Tikkuni Yerushalmi, continuing what he did in Al Yerushalmi, emendations, explanations of the Yerushalmi. I found a letter in the seminary, and then they also had it Spiro. This volume came out, I was very fortunate, it comes out in 2005. My little country, I call it, comes out in 2006, but I had done all the research before that. But they also quote from it. In November of 1930, Lieberman's already corresponding with Ginsberg. I have all the letters of Lieberman to Ginsberg. So one day I will publish these letters, I guess. I published one of them, we'll speak about one that I published in Saul Lieberman, the Orthodox. But he writes to him as follows. He says that I'm working on a great project on the Yerushalmi. It has to be this work. Yerushalmi Kifshuto. This appears in 1935. It's, by the way, you can buy it, but the newest printing of it, it's very nice. I'll tell you why it's nice, because they also, what they do is they include in the back many pages of Lieberman's notes, and then they include images of some of the pages of the notes. And here you see just one of them where he crosses out, you know, what he wrote. He was not afraid to cross out, and although he never republished the book, so you wouldn't know this, but that's from the newest printing. I do not have that one. I have the one from 1995, but originally appeared in 1935. So he says to Ginsberg, he says, I started working on a great project from the Yerushalmi, but I had to stop because you cannot work on brachos. This is what this is. It's Yerushalmi Kivshuto. It's his commentary on Shabbos, Erev, and Pesachim. But he says, you can't begin even on the first tractate, or any tractate for that matter, without knowing the entire Yerushalmi. So he's writing to Ginsberg, I can't start a commentary, let's say starting on Masechet Shabbat, without knowing the entire Yerushalmi. So he says that, so he did not resume his work until he had completed the entire Yerushalmi. When I say completed it, I mean know it, completed it all. This is an unbelievably high standard. Look, we know from Al Yerushalmi that he knew it already before 1930, he knew the Yerushalmi. But clearly he didn't know, he knew enough, I guess, to do emendations, but he didn't know enough to write an actual commentary of the sort he wanted to. What high standard is this? You can't write on one tractate without being a master on all the tractates. With such an approach, not only would there be almost no academic scholars focusing on Talmud, but very few commentaries by traditionalists. Most commentaries you get, the person, he learns a Masechta, and then he writes a commentary on it. And I'm not speaking about the Gadol Yisrael here, the average person. You go to any great yeshiva, they have people writing on it. Think what this means, to be an expert in the entire Shas, to write on one tractate. This is an unbelievably high standard. And if we had this standard, can you imagine? If we would have, maybe it would be good. We'd have much less being written. In fact, this reminds me of something here, which I just read today. If I can quickly find it here, I'll read it to you. I think you'll find this, because this takes us back to Rabbi Mazuz in terms of, let me pull it up quickly here, if I can, in his Parsha sheet, well, I don't know, Alone they call it, not a Parsha sheet, whatever. He sometimes, as we know, speaks his mind. He mentions, this is a note 19, that Rav Ovadia Yosef would, at nighttime, he would write his approbations on books. He'd get like 6 or 7 books a day, and he'd write his haskamot. And Rabbi Mazuz says, if I would receive all these books, you know, I'd explode from books. And then he says, Yesh svarim shehem lo shavim chatzi pruta, v'ata chayav, in quotes, lichtov lehem haskamot. He says, there are some books that are not worth even a chatzi pruta. A pruta is the smallest currency. You can marry a woman with it. He says, there are books that are not even worth that, but you're obligated to write a haskama. Then he says, alma haskama, what are you writing a haskama and approbation for? Hashkava, that's for the Sfardim. Sfardim don't have, they have these prayers like for the dead. So hashkava, tzarech lichtov aleihem. You have like a ceremony for the dead. Ezo haskama, hevavarik, ani tzarech lichtov, I have to write nonsense about this. He says, but Rav Ovadia hayim akabal akol basavranut. Rav Ovadia was better than me, he says. Rav Ovadia would encourage everyone. He says, you come to me, if it's nonsense, I don't want to write it. It deserves a burial, he's saying, rather than a haskama. So it's different with Rav Chacham Ovadia. So as I was saying, the unbelievably high standards. I'm going to read you something else he writes. What he says, page 49 and 50 in Spiro. This is what Lieberman says. And this comes, the original text he's quoting from, just to show you know where he's here. It was an article or an interview he gave to Michael Shashar, I guess. Without yeshivot, there cannot be any Chachmas Yisrael worthy of its name. That is, without yeshivas, you can't have academic studies. true Jewish scholarship will be sustained only by students and scholars who, after acquiring their religious knowledge, will also become accomplished in the sciences and scientific method. That is, you're never going to have academic Jewish studies in the area of Talmud unless you first have Talmid Chachamim of the old school who spent years in yeshiva. People like Shama Friedman are the exception. You have one in a generation like that, or Christine Hayes, I guess, perhaps. Without the yeshiva, there will hardly be any Jewish learning. The yeshiva could survive without modern Jewish learning. The yeshivas don't need that. But the modern Jewish learning cannot survive without the yeshivos. He goes on to say that the method of teaching and studying the yeshiva are necessary for these young people. And then later he goes on, you can turn to scientific methods. Point being that no one can be an expert in Talmud in the modern method without being a traditional Talmud Chacham. So then you're going to ask, what about Neusner and people like that? Wait till we hear what Shaul Lieberman has to say about that. But this is very important. Then he says, scientific methodology can be acquired in 2 to 3 years of study, but the Torah has to be studied for at least 10 to 15 years. Scientific methods can be studied in maturity. The Torah has to be studied from tender childhood. If you want to be a Talmud Chacham, you have to begin young and you have to study for years, 10, 15 years of devoting yourself. Talmud study, nonstop. Academic approaches you can pick up in a couple of years. But you need to focus on the real thing. Otherwise, you're not going to move beyond. I've seen it in my lifetime. Many, many examples of this. And no one has ever complained for all the learning they've picked up in yeshivas. You will not find someone who devotes themselves to 15 years to the academic study and then becomes a Talmid Chacham in 2 years. But you can find plenty of people who are great Talmid Chacham in a couple of years. How did Yaakov Ellman ever become what Yaakov Ellman became? Just to give you one example, the person who in years from now, people look back and say he is responsible for a change in direction of Talmud study. Great academic scholar. Yaakov Ellman, who I had the zechus of knowing, was a Talmud Chacham of Talmud Chachams for years before he even heard of academic study, sort of like a Shaul Lieberman type. And we have and all these great Londonim that who in the academic world, they all come from that standpoint as well. Okay, getting back. So if you recall, he goes to Hebrew University. He becomes a student of Yaakov Nachum Epstein. Yaakov Nachum Epstein is another example of someone with very great traditional Talmudic learning before he turns to the academic study. And then, of course, at university, you need a degree. So what was his degree? If you look at his Spiro on page 8, he will tell you that he graduates from the Hebrew University with a rating of excellent, acquiring a master's with a specialization in Talmudic studies and a subspecialty in Palestinology, Greco-Roman languages and culture, and ancient history. So he has a master's. Did he write a master's dissertation? Usually you're supposed to write a dissertation. Well, if you look in Spiro on page 92, they quote Halivni that he wrote a master's dissertation on Talmudic geography. I don't know if that's true, and I don't know if it survives, if it is true. No one has ever quoted a master's dissertation from him. Presumably he had to write it, but you never know. In those days, a new university, maybe just based on his knowledge or based on things he had already published. It could maybe based on even Ali Rishalmi. In the old university system in Germany, you could write something like a book like that and then present it to university and you'd be given the degree. You didn't actually have to attend it and have lectures there. In fact, Lieberman wants a doctoral dissertation based on in that way. He wants his dissertation to be done in that way. So I don't know if he actually what he wrote it on, if he actually did write anything else. Also on page 10, it quotes, he talks about why he didn't get a PhD. That's the important thing. He never got a PhD. He got a master's degree. Later on, Lieberman is described, I'll show you, here. Where is it here? In his book, Shekiyin, which we'll get to today, I hope. It has an English title page, and it was reprinted years later. And what does it say? Originally, it said Rabbi Saul Lieberman, dean of Harry Fischel Institute. But then in the later printing from 92, it gives the honorary doctorates, honorary doctorate JTS, honorary doctorate Hebrew University, honorary doctorate Harvard University, honorary doctorate Dropsy College. So he had lots of doctorates, but he never got a PhD. Now, how is it that he never got a PhD? And that's going to hurt him, because he was never able to get a full-time job at the Hebrew University because he needed a doctoral dissertation, and he did not have a doctoral dissertation. Spiro and Shochet take this up on page 10. It's an old story. Apparently, the story is that Lieberman wanted Tosefta Rishonim. He wrote a volume, I'll get to it in a little bit, four volumes on the Tosefta. Maybe that was actually what the Chazon Ish was applying to, the Tosefta Rishonim. And I think a commentary on Tosefta. He wanted this to be included, counted as a dissertation. But Epstein said no. He says it's not an analytical type of work. For a doctoral dissertation, you need an analytical type of work. I can tell you that today, in a Western university, it could be the greatest work Tosefta Rishonim, Tosefta Kipshuta, any of these things. They wouldn't be accepted as a doctoral dissertation because at least not without a lengthy introduction explaining what new contribution to knowledge. For good or for bad, you don't get doctoral dissertations in the West as a running commentary. You can't edit a text of Homer just with a running commentary on it. You need to have to make some contribution to knowledge in the big sense. And Lieberman, either because at that stage of his life he was not prepared to write such a work, or because he just was annoyed, he didn't do it. And that did block him. The truth is that he wasn't interested in those type of large vistas. He could have done it if he wanted to. Shakian, the book we're going to speak about today, could have become a doctoral dissertation, no question about it. But but he didn't submit it for that. And at least I think it would have been. When he wrote it, this is 1939. He's already gone from the Hebrew University. Maybe he thought it wasn't worth the time to do that. But of course, then he needs to make a living. How does Lieberman make a living? And it wasn't easy. I mentioned this briefly last class that he taught. If you look in Shochet and Spiro 8-9, it tells you exactly what he did. He worked as a clerk in the Tel Aviv Chamber of Commerce. He taught at the Herzliya School. He served as a part-time lecturer in Talmud at the Mizrahi Teachers College. He worked as secretary at the Shiva Shara Shemaim under Rav Chaim Leib Arbach, Rav Shlomo Zalman Arbach's father, who was head of the yeshiva, the Kabbalah yeshiva, and he taught. He taught at the Hebrew University. He taught a class. The problem was the class was very small, and the university in 1937 it had to stop it. In 1937, only had two students. So they couldn't put it on, and they couldn't hire him as a permanent teacher because he didn't have a doctorate. So what is he supposed to do? Well, we'll speak. I see it's not going to be today. It'll be next class. We're going to speak about Harry Fischel and what the Harry Fischel is. So we'll get to that. But before we go on, we have another 5 more minutes or so. Let me tell you a little bit more. In 1931, getting back to the Yerushalmi, he publishes a lengthy essay in Tarbitz, 109 pages. I don't know why this couldn't have been the beginning of a doctoral dissertation. Perhaps because it disagrees with Epstein. Maybe that's the problem. But it's called The Talmud of Caesarea, and which he argues that the three Bavot, Bava Kama, Bava Masiya, Bava Basra, were edited in Caesarea in the mid-4th century, some 50 years or so before the other Yerushalmi tractates. But Epstein disagrees with that. In 1935, again with the Yerushalmi, he published a work I just showed you. Yerushalmi Kifshuto, Yerushalmi explaining it in accordance with the Pshat. The edition I showed you, which has the notes of Lieberman, you can see this on Otzer HaChachma. In 1937, he publishes the first volume, and then it comes to four volumes of another very important work, Commentary on the Tosefta, Tosefet Rishonim. This was another work, a Tannaitic work, which people basically don't pay any attention to. Commentaries are not much in the way of commentaries. And this is Tannaitic work. It's vital to understanding Talmudic, the Talmud, both Bavli and Yerushalmi, is the Tosefta. So he writes a commentary. It's really, it's not like a Tosefta Kipshuta. It's more a collection. It's a commentary with a collection, all the Rishonim that cite the Tosefta, putting it all together. It first appears, they did a big memorial volume for Rav Kook, five volumes. And in one of the volumes, it has over 200 pages, the entire volume, the volume one, appears. And then it was printed separately. If you look in the Hakdasha, who was dedicated to, Lieberman dedicates it to Admor. That's how he refers to Rav Kook. We'll talk about the relationship between him and Rav Kook next class. Unbelievable respect he had for Rav Kook. And later he publishes three more volumes. I want to read you something he says in the introduction. There's a lot to be said, but in the introduction to volume four, which is the last volume he published, just to show you, this is one of his important points. I don't want to spend too much on the Tosefta. We'll talk more about the Tosefta when we do the Tosefta Kipshuta, because despite his love for the Yerushalmi, he takes a turn and his whole life is spent on the Tosefta, his major work. But he says as follows, and this is important, and this is what he stresses, not just here, elsewhere as well. In fact, remember this, because the great dispute between him and Rav Soloveitchik that we spoke about last semester, which we'll get back to, this is exactly what Rav Soloveitchik did not like. He says that the thing about the Tosefta is you have different manuscripts. And sometimes they say different things, they contradict each other. We saw what the Chazon Ish has to say about this. But Lieberman is not so quick to say, like others would, that so you have one Tosefta version which is correct and the other is incorrect. He says there are many times where he thinks the different manuscripts preserve Mesorot Shonot, alternative traditions. He says that in one manuscript we could have the tradition of Eretz Yisrael, in another we could have a different, because it could be Bavel. And then he says, don't look at differences of texts, alternate texts, as that one is an error and one's not, that you have a shibush or a tikkun or anything like that. Often, what we have here are preserved different traditions that go way back. And then this is on page 13. And then on page 15, it says as follows. Sof davar, summing it up. This is what his introduction is focusing on. He says, from this we learn that we have to take very seriously all the different versions we see in the manuscripts and in the medieval authorities. Don't make a decision that only one version is correct. It's possible that both versions are correct. Now, how could both versions be correct? If one version says, cites the name of Akiva, and the other one cites the name of Tarfon, why? What does he say? He says, everyone is correct in accord with the tradition that it comes from. The ho achati amitit, emet shel a text. Each one is correct. That is, they preserve the text. It's not like that the manuscript we have here, which says Rabbi Tarfon, you know, says Akiva, that one of the manuscripts is wrong. It's a misprint, a copyist error. No. We have to assume that these are authentic traditions. He says, afal pisha emet amuchatate story tirakachat. Yes. Only Rabbi Akiva said it, or only Rabbi Tarfon said it. They both wouldn't have said it. Or sometimes Rabbi Akiva says one way, and Rabbi Tarfon says the other, and then in other versions, the names are reversed. He goes, true. There's only one, in an ultimate sense, there's only one true text. However, by the time we get to the manuscripts that we have, there are two traditions. And it's not like we're not dealing with a copyist error. We're dealing with an entire tradition. Now, let's say in Bavel or Eretz Yisrael or among these schools, this is the tradition they have as to how the text should be read, who said it, what it means. So yes, if you go all way, way back, you could say that one is the authentic. But as Lieberman, he's a commentator. He's not interested in getting to the quote authentic, if there is such a thing going way, way back. He wants to explain each tradition in accordance, because he sees this as valid traditions, that have been passed on. We'll get more into that a little later. What I want to do, what we'll do next class, is I'll introduce you to his work Shiki'in, which is maybe my favorite, for the simple reason that he wants to show also, I just mentioned that people like to say that if you have different versions or alternate texts, that one is mistaken, a copyist error. And Lieberman says, no, they're all right, just preserving, could all be right, just preserving different texts. We have the same phenomenon with Midrashim and crazy Midrashim that are recorded by Karaites, that are recorded by Christians, that are recorded by also by Yemenite texts. And everyone assumes, well, these are Midrashim made, these are vulgar Midrashim made up by ignorant preachers. Or in the case of Pugio Fidei, you have Raymond Martini and other, and Pablo Christiani, these are falsehoods, ziufim, forgeries, invented by apostates or Christians to attack the Jews, to come up with phony midrashim, like that the day the temple was destroyed, the Messiah was born, things like that, all sorts of, and midrashim cited in Karaite texts to make fun of the Jews. What Lieberman's going to say is no. Don't think because you live in this little rational world that this is what Judaism must be. Judaism is much broader. And all these so-called Midrashim, or most of them, who says they're not authentic? He will say that some are not authentic, but no, well, these are authentic. And this is going to cause us to reevaluate perhaps what we see as in the tradition. It was easy for Yitzhak Baer to simply say, well, Raymond Martini was just making these things up. But as Lieberman will show us, of course he wasn't making him up, because the people who responded to him never said he was making it up. The Ramban, it is Vikuach, he doesn't deny these Midrashim exist. He says, famously, I don't accept these Midrashim. So we're going to see that Lieberman, through this wonderful work, Shekiyin, is able to expand for us what traditional Judaism has taught over the years. And I'll give you a very good example of this as well, that Lieberman does not mention. And then hopefully we'll move into, he gets a job. Lo and behold, Harry Fischel Institute. Who is Harry Fischel? I'm going to show you a building next class. I just found it. I'm sorry I didn't get to it today on Google, I don't know what you call it, where you actually see things, not Google satellite. I'll show you a building on the east side today. You'll be amazed when you see what Harry Fischel, what a pious Jew he was, and his building is still standing there for anyone to go see it. But that'll have to remain to next week. And actually, next week I'll be doing the show from Scranton, so hopefully we won't have any problems. Last time I had to send Rabbi Kelman all the good things to post, but I think I figured it out. So let me take the questions and the comments here, and for the Bubbavers and all. I'll have some more pictures of Lieberman. It's coming up. Baruch says both Lieberman and Finkelstein are wearing silver atarot. No, they're not both wearing. Just Finkelstein, if you remember. Hold on a second. Hold on. I thought we saw last week. Now I'm all confused here. Hold on. Oh, yeah, they are. Yes, they both are. Yeah, we spoke about this last week. I forgot that Lieberman was. What I said was that if you recall Finkelstein as a good Litvak, he's wearing his tefillin on Chol Hamoed. And I asked, well, Lieberman, why isn't he wearing? He's also a good Litvak. And I said either because his time in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel, you don't wear tefillin, or maybe because the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, was opposed to wearing tefillin. And Lieberman's connection to the Vilna Gaon, it was a very special connection, so it could be he felt he has to go like the Gra. So that's what it is. So maybe the Hasidim, like Bubbavers, who wear them, see them as cousins. Okay, the Bubbaver, whoever took the photo from YouTube class, should credit Dr. Shapiro. Well, he didn't that time, but you know how it is, Baruch. Once the pictures get out, they go. I've published all sorts of pictures, and they go everywhere, I'll give you another example of this later on. Jay Kelman, Rabbi Shimon Shkup's son was a Maski who taught at what today is Associated Hebrew Schools in Toronto. That was a problem with the Litvaks. Many of the children of Gedol Yisrael ended up to be Maskilim, but religious Maskilim, but Maskilim nonetheless. We had it also with the Kovno Rav, Rav Avram Dov Ber Shapiro, the Kovno Rav. He had many examples of that.
I'm not sure he was totally religious. My stepmother was a student of his, and she mentioned to, I don't know, I obviously don't know, but I think he was traditional, but I don't know that he would be classified as Orthodox. Okay. But anyway, that's it's not whatever. It's not relevant to the point, but just they say that they're all religious maskilim. I don't know that that's actually true. All the Gadol Yisrael.
Well, no, there are some who are not religious. I can give examples of them too.
Okay.
Plenty of them, but I mean, many of them, their sons became more open-minded. Barry says Shaul Lieberman did not wear Tfon HaChomo. Yes. He was a litvak. That's my suspicion. Either the Vilna Gaon or his time in Eretz Yisrael. Baruch says maybe he wore them, but had already taken them off. Could be. I don't know. We got to find someone who davened with them on, but it doesn't look like it because it looks like they're in the middle of davening. Furthermore, the picture I'm going to show you would have been after, so another picture. So I don't know. Rabbi Shudnow says, Lieberman said he couldn't continue Tosefta and Yerushalmi until he did Tosefta Kipshuta. Yeah. The Tosefta is really, you could say it's the building blocks for much of what you have in all of the Talmud. But it still was interesting that he didn't, that was his great love, but he moved on to the Tosefta. No, not Edmund, not page 118, note 118. That's the note in Al Yerushalmi. And Rabbi Shudnow has an autographed Al Yerushalmi. Very nice. William Gewirtz says that Boyarin wrote a fascinating article a few months ago in Tablet, and he said there'd be more articles, but he hasn't. I don't know, and I have no relationship to Boyarin, and so if anyone knows, you can ask him what the story is, but I haven't. And the person who's texting me about confessions, if you have something about it from Chachmei Ashkenaz, you can send it to me. I'll mention that there were Keach and others. I'll do that next week then. Okay. Chazon Ish was close to 20 years older than Lieberman. Yes, he was. We mentioned that. Shmuel, in what way is Meiri not part of the tradition? Does he just mean that the commentary on Meiri was not available, so Rabbanim who came after him didn't study his work? It's more than that. The Meiri, by the way, was, people assume, I can't tell you how many times you hear people say that the Meiri wasn't known to the 20th century when it was printed. By the way, the person who printed it was Avram Schreiber, Sofer, who also taught at the seminary, just another one of the Orthodox people who did, was he the great-grandson of the Hasm, great-great-grandson of the Hasm Sofer, I think it is, the son of the Hisaurus Tshuva, but grandson or great-grandson, I forget now, the Ksav Sofer, but whatever, it's not true. Yes, he published so much stuff from the Meiri, and Avodah Zarah and others, but we also knew the Meiri on Bava Kama in Shita Mekubetzes. But what the point of the Chazon Ish, and Rav Soloveitchik also was very sympathetic to this, is that poskim, the Shulchan Aruch and the great poskim, didn't use the Meiri. It was never used as part of their halachic argumentation. They never argued over it. They never wrote about it. So therefore, all of a sudden in the 20th century to come out and say that, and it's not just the Meiri, it's the Tshuvas HaRambam as well. Any text which hasn't been part of the tradition, of course you can learn it, but to then all of a sudden say, well, we're going to cite halacha, now we see the Rishon, the great Meiri says this, so we can rely on him. The Chazon Ish felt that in terms of practical halacha, he should not be included. But I dare say that the Chazon Ish's position or Soloveitchik's position is not accepted today. If you look at the post-scheme, they all cite the Meiri and they all cite the Tshuvas HaRambam and new texts. But that's a famous position of the Chazon Ish. Yes, as for the Palestinian Talmud, as Rabbi Shudnow said, then only the Jews were the Palestinians. It's like had the old saying, had the Romans, after putting down the revolt, the Jewish revolt, not change the name of Judea to Palestine, then there'd be we'd be fighting the Judean Liberation Organization. And yes, so we know if you look in Hebrew Sforim from before 48, it's the printed in Palestine, the Palestine Post. It was a lot very funny because a few months ago someone posted online a picture of I think it was the Palestinian Right soccer team. So I think it was Hadid, that model. She tweets it. You see, we have an identity, the Palestinian soccer team. And yet they quickly pointed out to her, if you look closely on all their uniforms, they have Jewish stars. And literally every single member of the Palestinian soccer team in the 30s was a Jewish person. So that talk about the ignorance. So that was that tweet was quickly removed. Logo Works says the Meiri was first published by the Mekitzin less than time a century ago. Yes, but we had the Shita Mekubetzes. It has the famous view of the Meiri that these laws, anti-Gentile laws, don't apply to contemporary Gentiles. That is mentioned already in the Shita Mekubetzes. The Chasam Sofer even deals with this. Then Rabbi Sofer, Avram Sofer, who was living in Italy, he also was rabbi in Greece in Corfu. If you come on our Greece trip, God willing, one day we'll go to it. We'll see there's still something in the synagogue in Corfu. His manuscript, his handwritten stuff is still hanging in the synagogue. So here's a Hungarian rabbi, ends up in Italy. Very, must have been a culture shock there. But he used, he's the manuscript in the university in Parma, and he came out with a number of volumes and his works. I have it right over here. The Beis HaBechira is found at every yeshiva. And yet, if you look there, you have notes of Lieberman. You even have, take a look in the back of the Chibur HaTshuva, which is the Meiri's great work on Tshuva. It's in Yonah Deyoma. Many people in yeshivas right now are studying with the Meiri essay on Tshuva. In the back of it there, you have the notes of none other than Hagaon Levi Ginsberg. Michael Frankel, my suggestion, elite Jewish studies academics invariably spent lengthy stays at traditional yeshiva. I wonder what I think of Boyarin. There are exceptions. There's always exceptions. Boyarin never. As far as I know, he never was in any yeshiva, Boyarin. But Shama Friedman. I mean, Boyarin doesn't really do traditional Torah, Talmudic study. I'm not saying he couldn't. And his first book he wrote was on Yitzhak Kampantone. Shows that he can, and but he's doing all this other stuff. But you look at someone like Shama Friedman, never spent time in a yeshiva. So you do have exceptions. There's no question about it. But for that matter, the Rav Soloveitchik never spent time in a yeshiva. Rav Herzog never spent time in a yeshiva. So what Lieberman was saying is that traditional study. You take someone like a Shama Friedman, he studied Talmud in a traditional fashion of learning sugyas for all those years. So that's what it is. Not so much being in yeshiva, but studying. I have to assume that Boyarin, for years, just sat and went daf after daf in the Talmud. Because he doesn't come from, he comes from a conservative background, I think, right? Just like a Schechter type of background. You say here, he came from Jewish chicken farm region, etc. Yeah. So I don't think he put much quality time in yeshiva. I don't think he was ever in a yeshiva. I know for a fact Shama Friedman wasn't, but who has to be in yeshiva? If you're at the seminary for 5-6 years and you're studying Talmud every single day for hours and hours and hours, that's being in yeshiva also. Like I said, Rav Soloveitchik was never in yeshiva. He knew how to learn.
Back in his undergraduate days, he did come from a conservative environment, and nothing in his behavior or obvious interests at that particular time. I think I recall he had a motorcycle and one. You know, gave any hint that he might.
Okay, but I don't know if Boyarin's such a good example, because I don't know if Boyarin could write commentaries, let's say, on Talmudic tractates, even though he's an Eloi. But I like to give the example of Shama Friedman, because Shama Friedman comes, his only education is out of the seminary, and he's a Gon Shabagonin, Shama Friedman. But you don't need to be in yeshiva. That's not what Lieberman said. You need to study Talmud. When I say study Talmud, page after page after page, every single day, hours and hours, you need to be infected with a love where you just have to study the Talmud. And you're not going to get that unless you devote yourself. People will see right through you very quickly. And finally, the last question, how did he handle the criticism he got for his views? Did it bother him? Well, I have an entire little booklet called Sol Lieberman and the Orthodox. We will spend a few classes on precisely this point, how the Orthodox responded to him, what his attitude was. Remember, he was part of the Orthodox world. And posthumously, how things affected him. It's fascinating that in this book, this comes out of B'nai Brak, the most Haredi you can get. Lieberman is treated with great, great respect. Perhaps because his cousin, the Chazon Ish, treated him with respect. I don't know. So it could be that the machlokas and the disputes during his lifetime as time goes on, he'll become more accepted even into the Haredi world. Don't say I'm crazy to say that. Rabbi Soloveitchik, during his lifetime, you would never find people learning Sefer from his, or he didn't really write Sfarim in his lifetime so much, but you never would find people studying his writings in the Haredi world. Today we are, 30 years after his passing, and throughout the yeshiva world, you find people studying the writings of Rav Soloveitchik, the Chiddushim on Shas. And once you start studying the Chiddushim on Shas, then you move into, and other areas, then you move into his other writings. So there's definitely has been a change. Finally, last thing. Lieberman made sure the Daily Minyan was quick. That's an old to get back to Gemara. That's an old tradition. We spoke about it in the yeshivas in Europe as well. Mel says that Mark Steiner had chavrus with Boyar when he's at JTS. Okay. Very nice. Thank you all. Like I said, we'll pick up next week. Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you very much. Yes, we'll pick up next week. And tomorrow morning, we'll pick up Rav Aaron Adler on Rabbi Soloveitchik on Rosh Hashanah. So it's sort of a different angle. And then Wednesday, we have Benny Gesundheit on Musings on the Machzors in the morning, Machzor Zichronot and Shofarot. And we have Haftorah of the Week. We have our regular schedule. I'm actually going to put, I don't think I've ever put this here yet, but on our, I didn't put it to everybody. On our new website, you can go to the event calendar page and list off everything coming up. I mean, I think people know you get our emails, but I just want to, if you want to take a look here, there it is. If you go there, it sort of has a new calendar. Maybe it can use some improvement, but if you want to take a look, that has all our upcoming programs. But tomorrow morning, 11 a.m., that's our next year. Then Wednesday, of course, 11. And we look forward to learning with you. And Mark, we look forward to seeing you next week. And we're going to miss a number of Monday nights, of course, coming up with Yontif and everything. But it's hard to believe Rosh Hashanah is around the corner, like 2 weeks tonight. But okay, I guess we can start wishing everybody a good year. We hope to see you before then, of course. And please, like I say, invite your friends. We hope to learn with you. And everybody have a wonderful night. Thank you very much. Laila Tov, everybody.
Toda rabba, Laila Tov.
Bakasha. Okay, Laila Tov. It's nice to hear all the people, you know, who studied with, you know, with Shaul Lieberman. And it's always nice to get there.
And Shalom Friedman.
Yeah, who I know less about, you know, but he's been in Israel a long time, I think, no? Or
Yes.
But he taught you
the 70s.
He taught you in the seminary?
Both places. Both New York, and then right. He came on Aliyah. And so we're talking about into 76, 75, 76, already in Israel.
Right. And you learned with him in New York and in Israel, you're saying?
Correct.
Okay. Very nice.
Zachiti.
Zachiti. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Okay. Laila Tov.